OYOTU.com.
Sign Language with Bruce Williams.
Hi, and welcome to episode 153 of Sign Language. I could say this will be the last one for the year, because it's the 30th of December, but the trouble is it'll actually be the first one of the new year, because this will come out on Sunday the 3rd. So, what's been happening lately? Not a hell of a lot. I can't remember if I had reached this point at the last episode, but the stereo mix of the movie is done. All I have to do now for Chad is to run off a 5.1 mix using the final stereo mix as a template. So that'll be fairly simple. And then record some video footage of my studio, a bit of the flying faders of the Mackie Control Universal control surface, just some basic screen capture stuff of me editing sound effects and, all that kind of stuff, which they can use in the lynda.com training. So I've been kind of taking it easy with that. I told Chad I'd get it done probably a month ago now, and I've just, the lead up to Christmas was pretty manic, so just didn't get that done. So I really need to get that done in the next couple of weeks if I can. But basically, the mix on the movie is all finished, which is great. I did kind of feel like I was at the end of my rope at the end of it, because Chad was constantly wanting everything louder. And I was like, dude, I hate the loudness wars. But we'll come back to the loudness wars. A long, 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 long time ago, there was a listener to this podcast by the name of Ernie. And Ernie used to send me lots of emails. And then he completely fell off the face of the earth for a while. We're friends on Facebook. But I got an email from him just a couple of days ago, and quite a lengthy one. And he said, "Long time, no talk. I used to have a Facebook. You were actually the one who got me started on it. And we talked on there some, but I deleted it when I learned how messed up of a company and my country is. I've also emailed you in the past about all the podcasts, I believe, Building the Pod, Sign Language, and Shutters Inc. Whatever happened to Shelton, by the way?" That's a whole other story, Ernie. I'll flick you an email on that. "I feel bad for you on some of my past emails, as I was just learning and I sounded, from my emails, like a complete idiot. Anyways, I'm so stoked you brought Sign Language back. I've just now had time to email you, but I have been listening. The whole movie bit and telling us how it's going is awesome and great info. I'm glad things are going great for you. I have a couple of questions. If you find the time to answer, great. Take your time. No hurry, mate. Number one, the loudness war. I've heard this term ever since you began the podcast, and I do have a firm grasp of what it is, and I have, not going to lie, listened to other podcasts, although yours is my favourite, but they all seem to cover this issue, and I've read countless articles, blogs, videos, etc., that it needs to stop, and that no recorder, aka producer, mixer, mastering engineer, seems to be guilty of it. So my question is, if they all claim to not be doing it, who's doing it? And how do we get them to stop?"
Well, the short answer, Ernie, is it's the A&R people in the record companies. They're the ones who've driven it. Right now, A&R, for those who don't know, is short for Artist and Repertoire. Your A&R guys in the record company are the guys who, they're not necessarily the talent scouts, although sometimes they are, but they're the ones who handle the artist from the record company's point of view, right? The artist has their own manager or even management team, but the A&R person is the manager for the artist on the record company side of the equation, right? And the whole loudness war has stemmed from this one little area of psychoacoustics, which, as I've said before, is the science of how we as human beings perceive sound, right? No two human beings hear sound the same way, right? Every one of us has a slightly different perception of the sounds that are going on around us. Even when we're standing side by side with our best mate is hearing the world differently to the way I am and the way you are. And the reason, well, there are many reasons for it. A lot of it is physical. Basically, everything from the chest upwards in terms of size and shape will dictate the way sound waves hit your body and how they travel around your body. The shape of the pinna, which is the soft fleshy part, the outer part of your ear, the bit that sticks off the side of your skull. The shape of the pinna will determine the way in which sound waves bounce into your ear. Then, of course, you've got environmental factors like, you know, over the course of your life, you know, whether or not you've been exposed to, you know, more or less loud noise, which, you know, may or may not have had an impact on your high frequency response. You know, if you've been exposed to a lot of loud noise, then your high frequency response will be lower than someone who's looked after their hearing. Right, so psychoacoustics is all about all these different factors that not only change the way we as humans all hear the world differently, but it's also about the way the brain processes auditory signals, right? Because right up until it gets into the cochlea, everything is physical, right? The cochlea is like a conch shell shaped device inside the inner ear. And running through the middle of the cochlea is a thing called the basilar membrane. The basilar membrane is, as the name suggests, a membrane, so it's fleshy. And sticking out of the basilar membrane, and imagine this is inside a conch shell typed apparatus, so it coils over on itself like a roll of carpet, except, you know, you've got the shell sort of keeping each layer separated from the next layer. But all along this membrane are all these hairs, right? And we're talking microscopic, right? Even the big ones are tiny, like so tiny you would struggle to see them with the human eye. And then the really, really small ones, right up at the tail end, at the skinny end of the basilar membrane, they are just so tiny you would seriously need a microscope to see them, right? And those hairs, they define our ability to perceive different frequencies. So the longer hairs at the start of the basilar membrane, they affect our low frequency response. And the further you travel along the basilar membrane, going round and round a circle into this conch shell type thing, the cochlea, as the hairs get shorter and shorter, so they relate to our perception of mid-range and then high-frequency signals. And the thing about the hairs on the basilar membrane is that they are very brittle. And once they are broken, they never grow back. And this is why we say you really got to look after your hearing, because once you damage it, it never restores itself, right? And it's because of these little brittle hairs on the basilar membrane. So all these hairs, they get shorter and shorter and shorter. And around the basilar membrane, inside the cochlea, is a fluid. And basically what happens is when the sounds hit the tympanic membrane, which is inside the inner ear, but it's sort of like the entry point to the cochlea, the fluid behind that vibrates. So sounds hit the tympanic membrane vibrates backwards and forwards, and that causes almost a standing wave, I guess, in the fluid around the basilar membrane inside the cochlea. And that wave travels through the fluid, and it interacts with these hairs that are growing out of the basilar membrane. And according to the intensity of the wave in the fluid, so that will excite different hairs along the basilar membrane, and that causes our perception of low frequency, mid frequency, and high frequency sounds. Now, I was saying that right up until that point, everything's physical, right? It's all about physical interactions of things, you know, sound waves bouncing off your body, sound waves bouncing into your middle ear, eventually hitting the tympanic membrane, which is, again, it's a physical interaction that causes this fluid to vibrate. That's a physical interaction. It interacts with the hairs on the basilar membrane. That's a physical reaction. And that's when it changes from physical to electrical, because these little hairs are basically like, they're like AC power cords that have been frayed at one end, right? And they fire off these little electrical signals inside the basilar membrane, where they interact with the basilar membrane. They fire off these little electric pulses, which then get transmitted to the brain. And so psychoacoustics covers all this stuff. Like, I'm sorry if I've sort of meandered about here, Ernie, but the psychoacoustics is just all about how all of this stuff affects what we hear, how we hear it, our perception of sound in the world around us, right? So how does this relate to the loudness wars? Okay. There is a known body of work within the area of psychoacoustics that says if you play the same piece of audio to one person and you play one piece of audio 3 dB louder than the other piece of audio, people will like the slightly louder version. And the reason is because when you play it a little bit louder, right, you all understand the Fletcher-Munchson curves, right, which are these graphs that draw out how sensitive human hearing is at different ranges of the audio spectrum, right? And we are most sensitive to sounds in the sort of 1K to 5K range, which is why most human speech falls in that range. And, you know, low frequency sounds we tend to be less sensitive to, and really high frequency sounds we tend to be less sensitive to as well. We hear them, but we're not as sensitive to them as we are to the mid-range frequencies, right? Now, when you play a sound a little bit louder, you start to hear a little bit more of the lower frequencies and a little bit more of the higher frequencies, because everything has been raised, and so those frequencies, which are normally sort of on the fringe of what we really hear well, suddenly are brought into focus a little more for us, right? So this concept of, if I've got two songs playing on two different radio transmitters, if I can play one of them, you know, 4 or 5 dB louder, so that this radio station sounds 4 or 5 dB louder on air than that radio station, then people will like this radio station. Now, it's a flawed argument. Flawed as in F-L-A-W-E-D, right? Blind Freddy can see how flawed this argument is, but bear with me, right? Radio broadcast engineers fall into this trap of thinking that if they can make their transmitter sound louder than the guy down the street, then more people will listen to this radio station than that radio station because it sounds louder. It completely ignores the quality of content argument, which is arguably of much more value, right? I would much rather listen to great quality content 4 or 5 dB softer than listen to crap content a little bit louder. And this is the thing that, you know, A&R people and radio broadcast engineers seem to miss. But let's come back to the A&R guys. They've fallen into the trap of thinking that if I have two artists, my artist here on my record label, which we'll call artist A, and then there's artist B who's on this other record label down the road, if they both have songs, and let's put all quality of content arguments to the side for now, if I can make my artist A's song sound 4 or 5 dB louder than artist B's song, then people will prefer my artist's song to the other artist's song, right? Now, you can see how flawed this argument is, right? Because we as consumers have a thing called a volume control, right? So it's a stupid argument. But We've been stuck with it for well over 40 years. This has been going on long before the digital age, right? Even in the analog age, there was, you know, this push to master stuff hotter and hotter, even on vinyl. However, vinyl, you know, was a much less flexible medium than digital is, and you could only push it so far with vinyl before things just went completely off the wall. Digital has allowed the whole loudness war thing to just get completely out of control, to the point where we have, you know, pretty much since the dawn of the digital era, and CDs came around in about 83 or 84, we've had this steady increase in the loudness of how much, you know, how loud music is mastered, so that, you know, A&R guys can be happy to think that their product is louder than their competitor's product. Like I said, it completely ignores the quality of the content argument and completely ignores the fact that the consumer has a volume control. If we want it louder, we'll make it louder. If we want it softer, we'll make it softer. You know, we don't need to have everything absolutely crushed to death just so the A&R guy can be happy in his, you know, superiority that his product is louder than the guy down the street, because it just doesn't work that way. But the sad thing is, mastering engineers have, you know, for at least the 20 years I've been on the internet, been, you know, crying about the way that they are forced to make their masters hotter, because if they don't, the record company will simply take the music that needs to be mastered to somebody else. You know, so the mastering engineers are the piggy in the middle. You know, they're being handed a product which may or may not have already been crushed by whoever did the mix. Generally, if you're working in professional circles, the mix engineer knows not to slam the product through a peak limiter at the end of his chain, because it's still got to go to a professional mastering engineer. And the more dynamic range you can give to the mastering engineer, the better he can do his job. However, there are a lot of backyard cowboys who mix a song, slam it through T-Rax, which was a pirated version, and then send it off to a mastering engineer and expect him to do wonders with it. And of course, he can't do wonders with it, because it's already had all the dynamics taken out of it through peak limiting. Once you've got square waves at the, you know, extremities of the waveform, then there's only so much you can do, you know, in mastering before things just get really ugly. So, you know, professional mix engineers know not to do that before it goes off to mastering. But the problem is, the mastering guys get hold of what, you know, is probably a really nicely mixed product, and it's a 24-bit file, and it's probably recorded at 96K, or if they're lucky, even 192K, and then they want to do their best work, just like everybody else in the chain, but they've got an A&R guy breathing down their neck going, yeah, it sounds great, man, but just make it 6 dB hotter or 12 dB hotter, you know. And, yeah, and the poor mastering engineer, he's got no choice but to give the client what they want, because at the end of the day, it's the A&R guy who's paying the bill, you know. It's like any service industry. If you don't give your customer what your customer wants, then your customer will end up going to one of your competitors and getting what they want. So the long answer to your question, Ernie, who's responsible? It's the A&R people, because they're the ones who dictate to the mastering engineers, no, it's got to be hotter, it's got to be hotter, it's got to be hotter. Thinking that if we absolutely crush it to death, make it super, 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 super loud when it plays off CD or as an MP3 or an AAC file as it is these days, then people will just love it because it's loud. Hello? No. No. Never worked that way. Isn't going to work that way. Not now. Not ever. And thankfully, I start to see the tide turning. You know, you're seeing more and more artists now really pushing back and going, no, I don't want my music crushed like that. I mean, there have been some really epic fails when it comes to the mastering of albums, you know, and I could name a few, you know, things like Red Hot Chili Peppers' Californication, things like Metallica's St. Anger, albums where the peak limiting was so over the top that the audio clearly distorts on playback. I've talked in the past about, you know, inter-sample clipping, you know, where, yeah, you can look at a digital waveform and go, oh yes, these samples all come up and up and up and up, and then they hit zero, and then there's this straight line across two or three samples, and then it starts to decline again. The trouble is, when you have to reconstruct that digital signal in the analog domain, there has to be a smooth line of, you know, fluctuating voltage between each of those samples. And if those samples are slammed up against the, you know, 0 dB full scale, then when it reconstructs as an analog signal, it can easily be, you know, 12, 18 dB higher than that, because there has to be these intermediate steps. Well, they're not even steps, because, you know, in the analog world, you're not dealing in samples. You're dealing in a continuously fluctuating voltage. And that voltage can easily hit another, you know, 12, 18 dB in between where two samples were. And so this is why you get this distortion when you try and play stuff back that's been super, super heavily limited, right? Anyway, I feel like I'm ranting now. You got me fired up, Ernie. So hopefully that has answered the question. But yeah, short answer, A&R people, I lay all of the blame at their feet, right? I honestly don't believe that there was ever an artist who demanded that their material be mastered hotter in order to make it sound louder. Because I think every single artist who has ever walked out of a studio wanted the finished product to be as perfect as it possibly could be. And peak limiting, you could argue, undoes some of the good work that was done up until the mastering point, you know, the point at which it was slammed through a peak limiter to make it hotter. So yeah, so I blame A&R people. If anyone else is listening that's got an argument for why it's not the A&R people, or that there's somebody else responsible, please let me know. I've certainly never heard another argument that laid the blame at anyone else's feet. All right, on to part two of Ernie's email. 20 minutes later. Sorry. Number two, Adobe Audition and Wave Editor. I purchased Audition 3, probably around the end of your Building the Pod podcast, for very cheap from one of those shady-looking websites that actually turned out to be legit. And while it's served me well for many years, and even today I try to muck through its issues with Windows 8.1, mainly the fact that it has trouble with MIDI and MIDI track VST instruments, I still have not found a wave editor that can touch Audition in the terms of actual wave editing, with the spectral display and all the options it has for importing and exporting to just about anything you can think of, and even its built-in noise reduction. I do a lot of nature and field recording, so the spectral editing has been a lifesaver. I know Sony's come out with this new Spectral Layers, but I can't see spending that much on a piece of software that does just that one thing. As I just do this for a hobby and upload some YouTube videos, check me out here, www.youtube.com/user/radiation8. Mainly the video I post below, as well as others where I recorded some creeks and babbling brook scenes that alternate with a 1080p point and shoot, and used a Zoom H1, Behringer mixer, and Presonus microphone, although I have upgraded to a Zoom H4N now and dual mics, that I edited all the audio in Audition. So I had a look at the link for the video that Ernie sent, and I'll put that link in the show notes. Ernie, there's just one thing I wanted to say. Love the scenes. Beautiful, peaceful ambiences for an hour and a half. I didn't sit there and watch a whole hour and a half, but I did hover my mouse along the timeline to see where the scene changes were. And when I found one, I then clicked to just before that so that I could, you know, see the transitions between one scene and the next. And one thing I noticed, and you know, I'm what I'm going to say is only my point of view. There's no right and wrong with this.
Okay.
What I detected listening to and watching these scene changes was it sounded like at some of those transitions you had, let's say, you know, scene one was ending and scene two was beginning. It sounded as though scene one's audio track may have been a mixture of a couple of different field recordings, you know, maybe one of water and one of the forest. And what I noticed was that either the fade outs of the various audio sources for scene one or the fade ins of the audio sources for scene two were not perfectly together. Right, like you might have edited the water sound effect and put a fade on it, and then you've edited the forest sound effect and put a fade on it, but the endpoints either weren't the same or the lengths of the fades weren't the same. And as a result, I'd hear one sound disappear just slightly sooner than the other one. Or if it was the case of the fade in, I'd hear one sound fade in and then a second sound fade in just a split second later. Now, like I said, there's no right or wrong. This is just purely my take on what I observed watching the video. What I would suggest is if it's Audition that you're still using, get in the habit. If you're using two tracks of ambience for one scene, get in the habit of selecting both clips and splitting them together so that they both have a sample accurate common end point or start point, depending on which end of the clip you're working on. And then do the same thing with the fades. Select both clips simultaneously and drag your fade on, you know, on one of the two clips, because that should give you the same fade on both clips. I mean, I'm pretty sure Audition does simultaneous clip fades like that. I know, you know, Reaper, which I use these days, does. And that will at least give you a consistency in the way all of the combined sounds for one scene exit from the, you know, the audio soundtrack. And the same with the fade-ins, obviously. You know, get your fade-ins to be, you know, exactly the same start point and the fade-ins to be exactly the same length. And that way you don't, you know, what's the circus terminology? It's not about letting the cat out of the bag. It's the, there's another term about, you know, giving the trick away, you know. By doing this, you're not giving away the fact that you've used multiple audio tracks to build up an ambience track. And there's no harm in doing that. Absolutely no harm at all. I mean, God, you want to see the ambience as I laid up for Chad's movie. You know, there were scenes where I'd have, you know, four or five different ambiences running in one scene just to get exactly the vibe that I wanted for the look of a particular scene. Yeah, so there's absolutely nothing wrong with layering up different sounds to build up a soundscape. No drama there at all. But yeah, I would prefer that they, yeah, all fade out together or all fade in together. But like I said, there's no right or wrong. If you did it intentionally, then ignore everything I said. All right, moving on. Anyway, my question is, have you come across any editor that can edit like Audition or even a DAW that has plugins that can edit WAV files? Mainly looking for spectral editing, but any input I'm sure everyone would like. Also, newer versions of Audition do not support MIDI. Are you freaking kidding me? What? Oh, I can't believe that. Like, how long has it been since I ditched Audition? It's got to be 5, maybe 6 years ago now. Wow. And they still haven't put back everything they took out in between version 3 and version CS5. Whoa! I'm so glad I dumped Audition when I did. I cannot believe that over 5 years has gone by and they still haven't got back to all the features that were in version 3. Ye gods. That's appalling. They deserve to be caned for that. Dead set. Sorry. To answer your question, tragically, no, I've not found another audio editor that is as brilliant at two-track destructive editing as Audition. And to me, version 3 was the pinnacle. It was all downhill after that. The new interface I found particularly clunky. It was nowhere near as friendly as the UI which Audition 2 and Audition 3 had. On top of that, you know, obviously everything after version 3 was missing features that version 3 had. And I've mucked around with one or two other, you know, two-track editors. These days I keep WavoSaw on my machine. Not because it's a brilliant... it does the job. But again, it's not as friendly as Audition. Version 3. But it does the job. Does what I need it to do. It has this weird quirk where you have to manually tell it what sample rate your sound card's running at. I couldn't work it out at first because I'd open a WAV file that I might have mixed out at, say, 48K, and I'd open it up in WavoSaw and I'd play it, and it had this really nasty, super high frequency, kind of metallic distortion artifact. And, yeah, given years of experience, I sort of worked it out reasonably quickly and thought, hang on, that just sounds like a sampling rate error. And then I worked out that my sound card was still trying to force playback to 44.1. And so I had to go into the preferences somewhere in WavoSaw until it, no, play this back at 44.1. And when I did that, it was perfect. Worked fine. You know, so it's a little bit clunky in that respect, in that you've got to stay on top of your sample rates and make sure that it's playing back at the right sample rate. Otherwise, you will hear this nasty high-frequency distortion. But it generally has a reasonably good tool set. It does support VST plugins, so if you've got VST plugins already installed on your system, they will open in WavoSaw. Yeah, it's great, and the fact that it's freeware is awesome. But you know what they say, you get what you pay for. Yeah, I still think I've never come across anything as awesome as the two-track editor in Audition 3, which is pretty sad to say, because I think version 3 must have come out about 8 years ago now, you know. So anyway, in terms of spectral editing, if you haven't already looked at it, Ernie, have a look at Isotope RX. Now, yeah, obviously it means buying software. However, Hart Schaefer, who was the product manager at Audition, well, he was actually the product manager of Cool Edit when it was still owned by Centrillium. He was one of the guys who got taken across, you know, picked up by Adobe when Adobe bought Centrillium's IP in 2003. So that's what, 12 years ago now. He and his team of engineers, you know, they developed the awesome noise reduction and the spectral view stuff that you saw in Audition. Hart then left Adobe and went to work for Isotope. And lo and behold, it wasn't long before you saw RX hit the scene. And RX basically is the fantastic noise reduction from Adobe Audition built into its own app, with a bunch of cool features that Audition never had. So if you haven't looked at RX, Ernie, do it. It is so worth it. Even if you just pick up the basic version, which, you know, okay, it's not cheap. I think it's a couple hundred bucks. But keep an eye out, you know, because they're always doing specials. You know, they do Black Friday after Thanksgiving, and they, you know, there's always, you know, times when you can pick up a deal, you know. Go to their website and get yourself on their mailing list, you know, and then you'll find out about all that stuff. But in terms of another two-track audio editor, no. I honestly have not come across anything as good as Audition version 3. Sad to say. All right, on to part 3 of Ernie's email. Number 3, microphones. How do you go about selecting, maybe purchasing new, a microphone to record a scene, instrument, or vocal. What specs do you look for, and what do you think is the most important thing in selecting or buying a microphone?
Well, I would have to say, first of all, know what it is that you plan to record. If you're wanting to, you know, record ambiences out in the countryside and record instruments and record vocals, then you're asking a lot, and you could probably do worse than falling back on the industry workhorse, which is the Shure, you know, 57. If you were just going to do outdoor ambiences, I would suggest looking for something with an omnidirectional pickup. If you're going to want to record stereo ambiences, I would say get yourself a stereo mic. Don't put yourself through the grief of trying to work with two, you know, normal mono microphones and then, you know, working out, am I going to do XY? Am I going to do MS? Am I going to do ORTF? You know, get yourself a stereo microphone. And, you know, to be honest, I don't own any stereo microphones because it's not the kind of thing that I do. So I can't recommend any particular brands or models of microphones, but I'm sure there are, you know, a bunch of great mics around. You could do worse than just having a browse around on sweetwater.com, you know, because if it's out there and it's worth having, they've got it. You know, you could always jump on some of the forums like Gear Sluts and ask some of the questions, you know, ask questions there. You know, someone will set you straight on what would be a good microphone for recording ambiences out in the bush, you know, in terms of a stereo microphone. If you want to go with a pair of mono mics, well then, you know, comes down to, well, I don't know. I guess just knowing what you want a microphone to do, you know. If you're wanting to record musical instruments, ask yourself, is it one or two types of instrument that I'm always going to use this microphone for, or do I want it to be a workhorse that I can slap in front of any kind of musical instrument? You know, if I'm doing, say, a recording of an acoustic guitar, in the perfect world, I'll have a large diaphragm condenser and a small diaphragm condenser. Why? Large diaphragms move slower, but they pick up low frequency sound better. Small diaphragm condensers move faster because they've got less mass, and that makes them more suited for high frequency response. So a small diaphragm condenser, I'll, you know, stick it halfway up the neck, but aimed at the, you know, sort of at the bottom end of the neck, not quite at the hole, just a little bit up towards the neck from there. And the large diaphragm condenser I'll have pointed at the hole. And generally I'll mic from, you know, probably 18 inches out from the guitar. If you'd, yeah, man, this is like asking how long is a piece of string, Ernie? There's so many different mics and so many different applications, you know, there's no one answer for this. You know, I guess, I don't even know what mic I'd suggest as a, you know, be all and end all for instrument recording, because there are so many applications and some mics cover certain instruments really well, but yeah, wouldn't be appropriate for other things. And then there's other mics that are the inverse of that. And wow. You know, if you've been listening to this, you know that these days the microphone I'm recording into now is a ribbon mic, which is a form of dynamic. And I love it. Love it to pieces. Wow. I'm going to respectfully step back from that question, Ernie, because, yeah, narrow it down a bit for me. give me some narrower goalposts, and then we might be able to shoot for something that works. I think the danger is trying to, you know, going with the mindset that you can buy one microphone and it's going to do everything for you. Yeah, I'm sure that, you know, you can find a microphone. Yeah, pretty much any microphone will do all of those jobs, but how well it's going to do them will come down to, you know, what it is. And yeah, wow, I don't know how to answer that. What specs do I look for? Well,
You know, if I want something that's not going to be too responsive to sounds that are a long distance away, I would go with a dynamic. You know, condenser mics tend to be a little more sensitive over a larger area than a dynamic is. Size of the diaphragm will certainly have a play on, you know, the sort of sensitivity to different parts of the audio spectrum. Like I said, larger diaphragms tend to do better for lower frequency sounds, where smaller diaphragms are better for high frequency sounds. I'd want to know what, you know, if someone was saying to me, I need to go and buy a microphone to do X, then I'd say, okay, these are a few that you should maybe be thinking of, you know. But I think the trap is falling into that idea of looking for one mic to do everything. All right. So, and he finishes his email with, thanks, mate. Love the podcast, as always. And tell Rob not to disappear. Love his emails. Oh, Ernie, don't encourage him. Don't feed the bears. Oh, dear. Now, through the week, in fact, it was this morning, I saw someone post a link in one of the audio groups I'm a member of on Facebook, and it was the best free VST plugins of 2015. And this was from bedroomproducersblog.com. I'll put the link in the show notes. They basically chose 50 plugins, all VST, all free, that came out in 2015. And there's a couple of really good ones in there. And, you know, they cover pretty much everything you would expect. I think there's 20 that are effects, 20 that are instruments, and 10 which fell under MIDI/utility. A couple of things that I did want to mention. There was number 3 on the effects list was the Sanford Reverb. And I noticed in the text that the guy who wrote it made reference to Ambience by Marcus at Smart Electronics. And I just wanted to say, I discovered Ambience probably 10 years ago. And this was in the days before I'd, you know, really understood convolution reverbs. And I was still using algorithm-based reverbs. And it was such a great reverb. I downloaded the free version and it had a NAG screen on it. And it was basically donationware at the time. And so I ended up making a donation and getting the license key for it. And, you know, so then I didn't have to worry about the NAG screen. And as far as algorithm-based reverbs go, Ambience by Smart Electronics was an absolute corker. And I still have it today, even though I very rarely use it. I do still have the DLL for it. And I noticed on Magnus's website at Smart Electronics, 5 years ago now, back in 2010, he removed the NAG screen. So it's free. It's still available to download. I don't think he's updated it in 5 years. But as, you know, algorithm-based reverbs go, Ambience is an absolute corker. Now, in this particular list, this Sanford reverb, I haven't downloaded it, haven't had a listen to it, but the guy who wrote this blog seemed to think that it was on a par with Ambience, so it's probably a great algorithm-based reverb if that's your thing. Number 5 on the effects list was MJUC Junior by Klanghelm, and this is an emulation of a Verimu compressor. So I immediately downloaded that this morning, and I actually tried it out on a song I was mixing today. Gotta say, I loved it. And it's called Junior because Klanghelm have MJUC, as in the parent version, which is like the bigger brother to the Junior, which is, again, it's a very Moo compressor, but it's just got more controls on it. I've got to say, the MJUC Junior, which I tried out, really, really happy with it. I tried it on one instrument within the mix, and I then used it as the, master compressor on the master output, and I was really happy with it. So I'm going to give that a bit more of a go, and who knows, if I fall in love with it enough, I might spring out for the bigger brother. And the other one that I found that was in the utilities section that I liked was Pechenegg Tremolo. And this was really nice because as well as being a tremolo, it can be used as an auto panner. And what I also liked about it was it has a rotary control that allows you to change the wave form of the oscillator from square wave through triangle to sine. And basically at any point in between. So you can get some nice shapes happening just by, you know, you don't have to set at one of those three points. You can, it's infinitely variable. And the last thing that I wanted to mention in this episode is that the app that James and I have been working on is now deployed in the Google Play Store. James tells me that he hasn't deployed the iOS version yet, although I'm hoping that by the time this podcast comes out on Sunday, the iOS version will be up as well. Now, at the moment, the only version that's up on the Play Store is the Pro version, which, you know, it's going to break the bank. Let me tell you, I'll, you know, soften you up early. It's $1.99, people. Better save your pennies. So what is it? It's called BitBandit. And essentially, it is a calculator that is designed for calculating hard drive space requirements for recording projects or for calculating bit rates given... go check it out. You'll work it out. It's great. Trust me, I wrote it. I love it. So what we're going to do is the Pro version will allow you to choose a channel count from 1 to 64 channels. So let's say you were going to go off and, you know, you were doing a mobile recording session, you know, and you were going to record 20 inputs and you were going to record at 48K and 24-bit, and you knew that, you know, the band was going to play a 45-minute set. All of that information can be entered into BitBandit, and it'll tell you how much hard disk space that's going to take. There's a couple of different things that the calculator does, and you can have a play with it. You'll soon work it out. Like I said, paid version's up on Google Play now. Hopefully the iOS version will be up as soon as the iOS version is up. If it's not up by Sunday, I will amend these show notes to include the link, but the Google Play Store link will be in the show notes for anyone who's on Android. It'll run on your phone, run on a tablet, obviously run in an emulator if you've got an Android emulator for your desktop machine. Would appreciate it if you guys could give me some support and pick it up. I mean, $2 is not going to kill you. And that's Australian, you know? If you're an American, that's like 20 cents. it's not super expensive. Would love to have some support from you guys on that. And would love to hear if anyone has suggestions for other features we could add to this calculator. Please flick me an email. Let me know. I am, you know, obviously, I feel like James has done all the heavy lifting with this, you know, because he did all of the coding. But he said to me, no, he said, you know, it's a 50-50 thing. He said, you know, you've worked on building an audience with sign language and, you know, So anyway, love for you to go and check it out and have a look and let me know, good, bad, or otherwise. You know, if there's areas for improvement that you can see, please let us know and I'll pass that on to James as well. Yeah. All right, I think that's about it. I would say have a happy new year, but that's been and gone by the time you hear this. So I guess all I can say is rock on 2016 and, yeah, I'll try and get more episodes out this year. All right, until I speak with you next, take care.
Sign Language.
Another audiotu.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out
signlanguagepodcast.com
or search the iTunes Music Store for questions, comments, and feedback. Email studio@audiotu.com.